the railing, Thick took the brunt of their teasing. It diminished briefly when the Prince and Chage took an evening stroll out on the decks. The Prince seemed invigorated by the sea air and his freedom from buckkeep. As he stood by Thick and spoke to him in low tones, Chade contrived to set his hand on the railing touching mine. His back was to me, and he appeared to be nodding to the Prince's conversation with his man. "How is he?" "Sick as a dog and miserable. Chade, the sailor's mockery makes it worse." "I feared as much. But if Dutiful notices and rebukes them, the captain will come down on them as well. You know what will follow." "Yes. They'll find every private opportunity to make life hell for Thick." "Exactly. So try to ignore it for now. I expect it will wear off once they become accustomed to seeing him about the ship. Anything you need?" "A blanket or two, and a bucket of fresh water so he can wash his mouth out." So I remained at Thick's side through the long and weary night, to protect him lest the taunting become physical as well as to keep him from falling overboard in his misery. Twice I tried to take him inside the cabin. Each time we did not get more than 3 steps from the railing before he was retching. Even when there was nothing left in his belly for him to bring up, he refused to go inside. The sea grew rougher as the night progressed, and by dawn we had a wind-driven rain soaking us as well as the flying spray from the tips of the white caps. Wet and cold, he still refused to budge from the railing. "You can puke in a bucket," I told him, "inside, where it's warm."
"No, no, I'm too sick to move," he groaned repeatedly.
He had fixed his mind on his seasickness and was determined to be miserable. I could think of no way to deal with it, except to let him follow it to its extreme and then be done with it. Surely, when he was miserable enough, he'd go inside. Shortly after dawn, Riddle brought food for me. I was beginning to suspect that perhaps the naive and affable young man truly was in Chade's employ, and assigned to assist me. If so, I wished he wasn't, yet I was grateful for the pannikin of mush he brought me. Thick was hungry, despite his nausea, and we shared the food. That was a mistake, for the sight of it leaving Thick shortly after that inspired my own belly to be parted from what I had eaten. That seemed to be the only thing that cheered Thick that morning.
"See? Everyone's going to be sick. We should go back to Buckkeep now."
"We can't, little man. We must go on to the Out Islands, so the Prince can slay a dragon and win the Narcheska's hand." Thick sighed heavily. He was beginning to shake with the cold, despite the blankets that swaddled him.
"I don't even like her. I don't think the Prince likes her either. She can keep her hand. Let's just go home."
At the moment, I agreed with him, but dared not say so. He went on.
"I hate this ship, and I wish I'd never come."
Odd how a man can become so accustomed to something that he no longer senses it. It was only then, when Thick spoke the words aloud, that I realized how deeply they echoed his wild skilling song. All night it had battered my walls, a song made of flapping canvas, creaking lines and timbers, and the slap of the waves against the hull. Thick had transformed them into a song of resentment and fear, of misery and cold and boredom. He had taken every negative emotion that a sailor might feel for a ship, and was blasting it out in an anthem of anger. I could put my walls up and remain unaffected by it. Some of the sailors who crewed the Maiden's Chance were not so fortunate. Not all were sensitive to the skill, yet for those who were, the unrest would be acute. And in the close quarters it would quickly affect their fellows. I spent a few moments watching the crew at work. The current watch moved among their tasks effectively but resentfully. Their competence had an angry edge to it, and the mate who drove them from task to task watched with an eagle's eye for the slightest sign of slackness or idleness. The congeniality I had glimpsed when they were loading the ship was gone, and I sensed their discord building. Like a nest of hornets that felt the thud of the axe echoing from the tree trunk below, they were stirred to a buzzing anger that had as yet no target. Yet if their general fury continued to mount, we could well be faced with brawls, or worse, a mutiny. I was watching a pot come to a seething boil, knowing that if I did nothing, we'd all be scolded. "Thick, your music is very loud right now, and very scary. Can you make it different? Calm? Soft, like your mother's song?"
"I can't,"
he moaned the words as he skilled them.
"I'm too sick."
"Thick, you're frightening the sailors. They don't know where the song comes from. They can't hear it, but some of them can feel it, a little bit. It's making them upset."
"I don't care. They're mean to me anyway. They should make this ship go back.
They can't, Thick. They have to obey the captain, and the captain has to do what the prince tells him, and the prince must go to the Out Islands.
Prince should make them go back. I'll get off and stay at Buckkeep.
But, Thick, we need you.
I'm dying, I think. We should go back.
And with that thought, his skill music swept to a crescendo of fear and despair. Nearby, a team of sailors had been hauling on a line to put on yet more canvas. Their loose trousers flapped in the constant wind, but they didn't seem to notice it. Muscles bulged in their bare arms as they methodically hauled on the sheets. But as Thick's despondent song soaked them, their rhythm faltered. The front man took more weight than he could manage, and stumbled forward with an angry shout. In an instant, the sailors had regained control of the line, but I had seen enough. I sought the prince with my mind. He was playing stones in his cabin with Sybil. Swiftly, I relayed my problem to him. Can you pass this on to Chade? Not easily. He's right here, watching the play. But so are Webb and his boy. Webb has a boy? That Swift boy. Swift-witted is on board. Do you know him? He came on board with Webb and seems to serve him as a page serves a master. Why? Is that important? Only to me, I thought. I grimaced with frustration. Later. But as soon as you can, tell Chade. Can you reach to Thick and calm him?
I'll try.
Drat! You distracted me and Sybil just won. I think this is more important than a game of stones, I replied testily, and broke the contact. Thick was sitting on the deck at my feet. His eyes closed, swaying miserably, his music a queasy accompaniment to the rhythm of his body. It was not the only thing making me feel sick. I'd promised Nettle that her brother was on his way back to her. He wasn't. What was I to say to her? I set it aside as something I couldn't solve right now. Instead, I crouched down beside Thick.
Listen to me, I said quietly. The sailors don't understand your music, and it frightens them. If it goes on much longer, they might...
And there I halted. I didn't want to make him fear the sailors. Fear is a solid foundation for hate.
Please, Thick, I said helplessly.
But he only stared stubbornly out over the waves. The morning passed while I waited for Chade to come and help me. I suspected the dutiful skilled a reassurance to him, but Thick stolidly ignored it. I stared at our wake, watching the other Buckkeep ships that trailed us. Three carracks followed us like a row of fat ducklings. There were two smaller vessels, pinnaces that would serve as communication vessels between the larger ships, enabling travelling nobles to exchange messages and visit one another as the voyage progressed. The smaller boats could use oars as well as sails, and could be used to manoeuvre the heavier ships in and out of crowded harbours. It was a substantial flotilla for Buckkeep to dispatch to the Out Islands. The rain dwindled to a drizzle, and then ceased, but the sun still hid behind the clouds. The wind was a constant. I tried to be positive about it for Thick. See how swiftly it drives us over the water. Soon enough we'll reach the Out Islands, and think how exciting it will be to see a new place. But Thick only replied,
It's pushing us further and further from home. Take me back now.
Riddle brought us a noon meal of hard bread, dried fish and watery beer. I think he was glad to be out on the deck. The guard was expected to stay below and out of the sailors' way. No one had said that the more they kept us separate, the less chance there was for fighting, but we all knew it. I spoke little, but Riddle chattered away, letting me know that the guardsmen below were also out of sorts. Some were seasick, who swore they had never been bothered by that ailment before. That was not good news to me. I ate, and I managed to keep my food down, but I couldn't persuade Thick even to nibble on the sea bread. Riddle took our dishes and left us alone again. When Chade and the prince finally appeared, my impatience and anger had been worn away to a dull resignation. While the prince spoke to Thick, Chade swiftly conveyed to me how difficult it had been for the prince and him to get out of the cabin alone. In addition to Webb, Sybil and Swift, no less than three other nobles had come to his cabin to visit and lingered to talk long. As Chade had pointed out earlier, there was little else to occupy the time, and the nobles who had accompanied the prince had done so to ingratiate themselves with him. They take advantage of every moment. So, when are we to work in skill lessons? I asked him very softly. He scowled. I doubt that we'll manage much time for those, but I'll see what can be done. Dutiful didn't have any more success with Thick than I had. Thick stared out sullenly over the ship's wake while the prince spoke earnestly to him. "Well, at least we managed to get away without Lord Golden," I observed Chade. He shook his head. "And that was far more difficult than I expected it to be. I imagine you heard of his blocking the docks in an attempt to board. He only gave up on that when the city guard arrived and arrested him."
"You had him arrested?"
I was horrified.
"Now, lad, be easy. He's a nobleman, and his offence is a fairly trivial one. He'll be treated far better than you were. And they'll only hold him 2 or 3 days, just long enough for all the out-island-bound ships to be gone. It seemed the easiest way to deal with him. I didn't want him coming up to Buckkeep Castle and confronting me, or begging favour of the Queen. She knows why we did this, doesn't she?"
"She does. She doesn't like it, however. She feels a great debt to the fool, but don't worry, I left enough hurdles that it will be difficult, if not impossible, for Lord Golden to get an audience with her." I had not thought my spirits could sink lower, but now they did. I hated to think of the fool imprisoned and then snubbed by Buckkeep's royalty. I knew how Chade would have worked it, a word there, a hint, a rumour that Lord Golden was not in the Queen's graces any more. By the time he was out of the jail, he'd be a social outcast, a penniless social outcast with outstanding debts. I'd only meant to leave him safely behind, not put him into such a position. I said as much to Chade.
"Oh, don't worry about him, Fitz. Sometimes you behave as if no one can manage without you. He's a very capable, very resourceful creature. He'll cope. If I'd done any less, he'd be on our heels right now."
And that, too, was true, but scarcely comforting.
"Fitz's seasickness can't go on much longer," Chade observed optimistically, "and when it passes I'll put it about that Thick has become attached to you. That will give you a good reason to be at his side, and sometimes in his chamber adjacent to the prince's. Perhaps we shall have more time to confer that way."
"Perhaps," I said dully. Despite the prince's conversation with Thick, I sensed no lessening of his discordant music. It wore on my spirits. By an effort of will I could convince myself that Thick's nausea was not mine, but it was a constant effort.
"Are you sure you don't want to come back to the cabin?" Dutiful was asking him.
"No, the floor goes up and down."
The prince was puzzled.
"The deck moves up and down here, too."
It was Thick's turn to be confused.
"No, it doesn't. The boat goes up and down on the water. It's not as bad."
"I see."
I saw Dutiful surrender any hope of explaining it to Thick.
"In either case, you'll soon get used to it, and the seasickness will go away."
"No, it won't,"
Thick replied darkly.
"Sada said that everyone will say that, but it isn't true. She got sick every time she went on a boat, and it never went away, so she wouldn't come with me."
I was beginning to dislike Sada, and I'd never even met the woman.
"Well, Sada is wrong," Chade declared briskly.
"No, she isn't,"
Thick replied stubbornly.
"See? I'm still sick."
And he leaned out over the railing again, retching dryly.
"He'll get over it," Chade said.
But he did not sound as confident as he had. "Do you have any herbs that might help him?" I asked. "Ginger, perhaps." Chade halted.
"An excellent idea, Bajalok, and I do believe I have some. I'll have the cook make him a strong ginger tea and send it up to you."
When the tea arrived, it smelled as much of valerian and sleep balm as it did of ginger. I approved of Chade's thought. Sleep might be the best cure for Thick's determined seasickness. When I offered it to him, I firmly told him that it was a well-known sailor's antidote to seasickness, and that it was certain to work for him. He still regarded it doubtfully. I suppose my words did not carry as much weight as Sada's opinion. He sipped it, decided he liked the ginger, and downed the whole cup. Unfortunately, a moment later he spewed it up just as swiftly as it had gone down. Some of it went up his nose, the ginger scalding the sensitive skin, and that made him adamantly refuse to try any more, even in tiny sips. I had been on board for 2 days. Already it seemed like 6 months. The sun eventually broke through the clouds, but the wind and flying spray snatched away whatever warmth it promised. Huddled in a damp wool blanket, Thick fell into a fitful sleep. He twitched and moaned through the nightmares swept with his song of seasickness. I sat beside him on the wet deck, sorting my worries into useless piles. It was there that Webb found me. I looked up at him, and he nodded gravely down at me. Then he stood by the rail and lifted his eyes. I followed his gaze to a seabird sweeping lazy arcs across the sky behind us. I had never met the creature, but I knew she must be Risk. The wit bond between man and bird seemed a thing woven of blue sky and wild water, at once calm and free. I basked in the edges of their shared pleasure in the day, trying to ignore how it whetted the edge of my loneliness. Here was the wit magic at its most natural, a mutual bond of pleasure and respect between man and beast. His heart flew with her. I could sense their communication and imagine how she shared her joyous flight with him. It was only when my muscles relaxed that I realized how tense I had been. Thick sank into a deeper sleep, and some of the frown eased from his face. The wind in his skill song took on a less ominous note. The calm that emanated from Webb had touched us both. But my awareness of that came slowly. His warm serenity pooled around me, diluting my anxiety and weariness. If this was the wit, he was using it in a way I'd never experienced before. This was as simple and natural as the warmth of breath. I found myself smiling up at him, and he returned the smile, his teeth flashing white through his beard. "It's a fine day for prayer, but then most days are." "That's what you were doing, praying." At his nod, I asked, "For what do you petition the gods?" He raised his brows. "Petition? Isn't that what prayer is? Begging the gods to give you what you want?" He laughed, his voice deep as a booming wind, but kinder. "I suppose that is how some men pray. Not I. Not anymore."
"What do you mean?"
"Oh, I think the children pray so to find a lost doll, or that father will bring home a good haul of fish, or that no one will discover a forgotten chore. Children think they know what is best for themselves, and do not fear to ask the divine for it. But I have been a man for many years, and I should be shamed if I did not know better by now."
I eased my back into a more comfortable position against the railing. I suppose if you are used to the swaying of a ship, it might be restful. My muscles constantly fought against it, and I was beginning to ache in every limb.
"So, how does a man pray, then?"
He looked on me with amusement, then levered himself down to sit beside me.
"Don't you know? How do you pray, then?"
"I don't." And then I rethought, and laughed aloud. "Unless I'm terrified. Then I suppose I pray as a child does. Get me out of this, and I'll never be so stupid again. Just let me live." He laughed with me.
"Well, it looks as if, so far, your prayers have been granted. And have you kept your promise to the divine?"
I shook my head, smiling ruefully.
"I'm afraid not. I just find a new direction to be foolish in." "Exactly. So do we all. Hence, I've learned I am not wise enough to ask the divine for anything.
So, how do you pray, then, if you are not asking for something?"
"Ah, well, prayer for me is more listening than asking, and after all these years I find I have but one prayer left. It has taken me a lifetime to find my prayer, and I think it is the same one that all men find, if they but ponder on it long enough."
"And that is?"
"Think about it," he bade me with a smile.
He stood slowly and gazed out over the water. Behind us, the sails of the following ships were puffed out like the throats of courting pigeons. They were, in their way, a lovely sight.
"I've always loved the sea. I was on boats ever since before I could speak. It saddens me that your friend's experience of it must be so uncomfortable. Please tell him that it will pass."
"I've tried. I don't think he can believe me.
A pity. Well, best of luck to you, then. Perhaps when he wakes he'll feel better."
He began to walk away, but I remembered abruptly that I had other business with him. I came to my feet and called after him. "Webb, did Swift come aboard with you, the boy we spoke of before?" He halted, and turned to my question.
"Yes. Why do you ask?"
I beckoned him closer, and he came. "You recall that he is the boy that I asked you to talk with, the one who is witted."
"Of course. That was why I was so pleased when he came to me and offered to be my page, if I would take him on and teach him." "As if I even knew what a page is supposed to do."
He laughed at such nonsense, and then sobered at my serious face.
"What is it?"
I had sent him home.
I discovered that he did not have his parents' permission to be at Buckkeep at all. They think that he has run away and are greatly grieved by his disappearance. Webb stood still and silent, digesting this news, his face showing no expression. Then he shook his head regretfully. It must be a terrible thing for someone you love to vanish, and leave you always wondering what became of him. An image of Patience sprang into my mind. I wondered if he had intended that his words prick me. Perhaps not, but the possible criticism made me irritable all the same. I told Swift to go home. He owes his parents his labour until he either reaches his majority or is released by them. So some say, Webb said, in a tone that indicated he might disagree. But there are ways parents can betray a child, and then I think the youngster owes them nothing. I think that children who are mistreated are wise to leave as swiftly as they can. Mistreated? I knew Swift's father for many years. Yes, he will give the lad a cuff or a sharp word if the boy has earned it. But if Swift claims he was beaten or neglected at home, then I fear that he lies. That is not Burrick's way. My heart sank that the boy could have spoken so of his father. Webb shook his head slowly. He glanced at Thick to assure himself that the man was still sleeping and spoke softly. There are other types of neglect and deprivation. To deny what unfolds inside someone. To forbid the magic that comes unbidden. To impose ignorance in a way that invites danger. To say to a child, you must not be what you are. That is wrong. His voice was gentle, but the condemnation was without compassion. He raises his son as he was raised, I replied stiffly. It felt odd to defend him, for I had so often railed against Burrick for what he had done to me. And he learned nothing. Not from having to deal with his own ignorance. Not from what it did to the first lad he treated so. I try to pity him. But when I consider all that could have been, had you been properly educated from the time you were small. He did well by me, I snapped. He took me to his side when no one else would have me, and I'll not hear ill spoken of him. Webb took a step back from me. A shadow passed over his face. Murder in your eyes, he muttered. The words were like being doused with cold water. But before I could ask what he meant by them, he nodded to me gravely. Perhaps we shall speak again of this later. And he turned and paced away from me. I recognized his walk. It was not flight. It was how Burrick would withdraw from an animal that had learned viciousness from bad treatment and had to be slowly retrained. It shamed me. Slowly, I sat down beside Thick again. I leaned back against the railing and closed my eyes. Perhaps I could doze a bit while he slept. But it seemed I had no sooner closed my eyes than his nightmare threatened me. Closing my eyes was like venturing downstairs into the noisy, smoky common room of a cheap inn. Thick's nauseous music swirled up into my mind, while his fears amplified the roll of the ship into a terrifying series of plunges and leaps without a pattern. I opened my eyes. Enduring sleeplessness was better than being swallowed by that bad dream. Riddle brought me a pan of salty stew and a mug of watery beer while Thick still dozed. He'd brought his own rations as well, probably to enjoy eating on deck rather than in the cramped hold below. When I started to waken Thick to share the food, Riddle stopped me.
Let the poor moron sleep, if he's fortunate enough to be able to. He's the envy of every guardsman below.
And why is that? He lifted one shoulder in a hapless shrug.
I can't say. Perhaps it's just the close quarters, but tempers are tight.
No one's sleeping well. Half of them are avoiding food for fear it won't stay down. And some of them are seasoned travellers. If you do manage to doze off, someone shouting out in a dream wakes you. Perhaps in a few days things will settle down. Right now, I'd rather stand in a pit surrounded by snarling dogs than go back down there. There were two fistfights just a moment ago, over who got fed first. I nodded sagely, trying to conceal my anxiety. I'm sure things will settle in a day or so. The first few days of a voyage are always difficult. I was lying through my teeth. Usually the first few days were the best, while the journey was still a novelty and before the tedium set in. Thick's dreams were poisoning the guard's sleep. I tried to be congenial while waiting for Riddle to leave. As soon as he took our empty dishes and departed, I leaned over and shook Thick awake. He sat up with a wail like a startled child.
Shh, now. You're not hurt. Thick, listen to me.
No, shh. and listen. This is important. You have to stop your music, or at least make it quieter. His face was wrinkled like a prune, with anger and hurt feelings that I had so roughly awakened him. Tears stood in his little round eyes.
I can't,
he wailed.
I'm going to die.
The men working on deck turned scowling faces our way. One muttered angrily and made a sign against ill luck towards us. On some level, they knew the source of their uneasiness. He snuffled and sulked as I talked to him, but firmly resisted any suggestion that he could either dampen his song or overcome his seasickness and fear. I became fully aware of the strength of his wild skilling only when I tried to reach the prince through the cacophony of thick emotions. Chade and the prince had probably increased the strength of their walls without even noticing they were doing so. Skilling to them was like shouting into a blizzard. When Dutiful realized how difficult it was for him to understand me, I felt panic touch him. He was in the midst of a meal and could not graciously leave. Even so, he found some way to make Chade aware of our crisis. They brought the meal to a hasty end and hastened out on deck to us. By then, Thick had dozed off again. Chade spoke quietly. I can mix a powerful sleeping draught and we can force it down him. Dutiful winced.
I'd rather not. Thick does not soon forget ill-treatment. Besides, what would we gain from it? He sleeps now, and still his song is enough to torment the dead.
Perhaps if I put him into a very deep sleep, Chade ventured uncertainly. We'd be risking his life, I interrupted, with no assurance that his song would stop.
We have only one option, the prince said quietly. Turn back and take him home. Put him off the ship.
We can't, Chade was aghast. We'll lose too many days, and we may need thick strength when we actually confront the dragon.
Lord Chade, we are seeing the full effects of thick strength now, and we are seeing that it is not disciplined nor controlled by us.
There was a new note in the prince's voice, a monarch's tone. It reminded me of Verity, and his carefully weighted words. It made me smile, and that earned me an odd frown from the prince. I hastened to clarify my own thoughts. Right now, Thick's strength is not governed, not even by him. He does not intend us ill, but his music threatens us all. Think what sort of damage he might do were he provoked to true anger, or badly hurt. If we can cure his seasickness and calm his song, Thick will remain a double-edged blade. Unless we can find a sure discipline for his strength, he can threaten us when he is unsettled. Perhaps we would be wiser to go back and put him ashore.
We can't go back, Chade insisted.
Then, as both Dutiful and I stared at him, he pleaded,
Let me have one more night to ponder. I'm sure I'll think of a solution.
And give him one more night to become accustomed to the ship. Perhaps by dawn his seasickness might have passed.
Very well, Dutiful replied after a moment.
Again there was that note in his voice. I wondered how he was learning it, or if he was simply growing into his role as ruler. In either case, I was glad to hear it. I was not sure if his decision to grant Chade one more day was a wise one or not. Yet it was his decision, and he had made it with confidence. That was a thing to value. When Thick awoke, he was sick again. I suspected that his prolonged hunger had as much to do with his weakness now as his seasickness did. He was sore from retching, for the muscles of his belly ached, and his throat was raw. I could not persuade him to take anything except water, and that he accepted reluctantly. The day was neither cold nor warm, but Thick shivered in his damp clothes. They chafed him, but my suggestion that we go into his cabin and change or get warm met angry resistance. I longed to simply pick him up and drag him there, but knew he would scream and fight me, and that his music would become wild and violent. Yet I feared that he might soon slip into real illness. The slow hours passed miserably, and not just for us. Twice I heard the mate explode in anger at his bad-humoured crew. The second time he threatened a man with a lashing if he didn't show a more respectful face. I could feel the tension building aboard the ship. In late evening, the rain returned as a pervasive misting. I felt as if I had not been dry for a week. I put my blanket over Thick, hoping the weight of wool would be good for some warmth. He was dozing fitfully on the deck, twitching in his sleep like a dog with nightmares. I had often heard the jest, "You can't die from seasickness, but you wish you could." Now I wondered if it was wrong. How long could his body accept this treatment? My wit made me aware of Webb before his silhouette lumbered out of the dim light of the ship's lantern to stand over me.
"You're a faithful man, Tom Badgerlock," he observed as he hunkered down beside me. "This can't be a pleasant duty, but you've not left his side even for a moment." His praise both warmed me and made me uncomfortable. "It's my responsibility," I replied, letting his compliment slide past me. "And you take it seriously." "Barrick taught me that," I said, a bit testily. Webb laughed easily. "Ha! And he taught you to hang on to a grievance like a pit dog hanging on to a bull's nose. Let it go, Fitzchivalry Farseer. I'll say no more of the man." "I wish you would not bandy that name about so casually," I said, after a moment of heavy quiet. "It belongs to you. It's a piece of you that's missing. You should take it back." "He's dead, and better left that way for the sake of all I hold dear." "Is it truly for them, or is it for yourself?" he asked of the knight. I wasn't looking at him. I was staring out over the stern, watching the other ships that trailed us through the watery night. They were black hulks, their sails blotting out the stars behind them. The lanterns they bore rose and fell with them, distant moving stars. "Webb, what do you want of me?" I asked him at last. "Only to make you think," he answered soothingly. "Not to make you angry, though I seem to excel at that. Or perhaps your anger is always there, festering inside you, and I am the knife that lances the boil and lets it burst forth." I shook my head at him silently, not caring if he could or could not see me. I had other things to deal with right now, and wished I were alone. As if he could read my thoughts, he added, "And tonight I did not even intend to start you on your thinking path. Actually, I came here to offer you respite. I'll sit vigil with Thick, if you wish to take a few hours to yourself. I doubt you've slept properly since you took up this watch." I longed to move about freely on my own, to see what the temper was on the rest of the ship. Even more than that, I longed for a little unguarded sleep. The offer was incredibly attractive. It therefore made me immediately suspicious. "Why?" Webb smiled. "Is it that unusual for people to be nice to you?" His question jolted me in an odd way. I took a breath. "Sometimes it seems that way, I suppose." I rose slowly, for I had stiffened in the night chill. Thick muttered in his uneasy rest. I raised my arms over my head and rolled my shoulders as I arrowed a swift thought to Dutiful. "Webb is offering to take over my watch of Thick for a time. May I allow this?" "Of course." He seemed almost surprised that I had asked. But then, sometimes my prince trusted too easily. "Please let Chade know." I felt Dutiful's agreement. I spoke aloud to Webb at the end of my stretch. "Thank you. I'll take you up on your offer, very gratefully." I watched him settle himself carefully beside Thick and take the smallest sea pipes I'd ever seen from inside his shirt. Sea pipes are probably the most common musical instrument in any fleet, for they withstand both bad weather and careless handling. It takes little to learn to play a simple tune on them, yet a talented player can entertain like a buckkeep minstrel with them. I wasn't surprised to see them in Webb's hands. He'd been a fisherman. He probably still was, in many ways. He waved me away. As I departed, I heard a breathy sigh of music. He was playing, very softly, a child's tune on his pipes. Had he instinctively known, that might soothe Thick. I wondered why I hadn't thought of music as a way to comfort him. I sighed. I was becoming too set in my ways. I needed to remember how to be flexible. I went to the galley in the hope of begging something hot to eat. Instead, I got hard bread and a piece of cheese no bigger than two fingers. The cook let me know I could consider myself fortunate for being allowed that. She didn't have food to waste. She didn't, not aboard this top-heavy, overpopulated tub. I had hoped for wash water, just enough to splash the salt from my hands and face, but she told me I hadn't a prayer of that. I'd had my share for the day, hadn't I? I should take what I was issued and be happy with it. Guardsman, no idea what life aboard a vessel required of a man in self-discipline. I retreated from her sharp tongue. I longed to stay above decks to eat, but I was out of my territory there, and the sailors were in a mood to prove it to me. So I went below, down to where the rest of the guard snored and muttered and played cards by the swinging light of a lantern. Our days at sea had not improved the smell of our quarters. I found that Riddle had not exaggerated the ill humour of the men.
The comments of one man on the returning nursemaid would have been enough justification for a fight if I'd wanted one. I didn't, and managed to shed his insults, eat my food hastily and dig my blanket out of my sea chest. Finding a place to stretch out was impossible. Prone guardsmen littered the floor. I curled up in their midst. I would have preferred to sleep with my back to a wall, but there was no hope of that. I eased off my boots and loosened my belt. The man next to me muttered nastily and rolled over as I tried to settle on the deck and cover most of myself with my blanket. I closed my eyes and breathed out, reaching desperately for unconsciousness, grateful for the opportunity to close my eyes and sleep. At least in my dreams I could escape this nightmare. But as I crossed the dim territory between wakefulness and sleep, I recognized that perhaps I held the solution to my problems. Instead of wallowing my way into full sleep, I slid sideways through it, seeking nettle. My task was harder than I had expected. Thick's music was here, and finding my way through it was like blundering through brambles in a mist. No sooner did I think of that than the sounds sprouted tendrils and thorns. Music should not hurt a man, but this did. I staggered through a fog of sickness, hunger and thirst, my spine tight with cold, and my head pounding with the discordant music that snatched and dragged at me. After a time I halted. "It's a dream," I said to myself, and the brambles writhed mockingly at my words. As I stood still, pondering my situation, they began to wrap around my legs. "It's a dream," I said again. "It can't hurt me." But my words did not prevail. I felt the thorns bite through my leggings into my flesh as I staggered forward. They tightened their grip and held me fast. I halted again, fighting for calm. What had begun as Thick's skill suggestion was now my own nightmare. I straightened up against the weight of the thorny vines, trying to pull me down, reached to my hip and drew Verity's sword. I slashed at the brambles, and they gave way, wriggling away like severed snakes. Encouraged, I gave the sword a blade of flame that singed the writhing plants and lit my way through the encroaching fog. "Go uphill," I told myself. "Only the valleys are full of mist. The hilltops will be clean and bare." And it was so. When I finally struggled clear of Thick's skill fog, I found myself at the edges of Nettle's dream. I stood for a time staring up at the glass tower on the hilltop above me. I recognized the tale. The hillside above me was littered with tangling threads. As I waded in, they clung like a spider's web. I knew that Nettle was aware of me. Nonetheless, she left me to my own devices, and I floundered through the ankle-deep tangle that represented all the broken promises her false lovers had made to the princess. In the old tale, only a true-hearted man could tread such a path without falling. In the dream, I had become the wolf. All four of my legs were soon bound by the clinging stuff, and I must needs stop and chew myself clear of it. For some reason the thread tasted of anise, a pleasant enough flavour in moderation, but choking by the mouthful. When I finally reached the glass tower, my chest was wet and my jaws dripped saliva. I gave myself a shake, droplets flying, and then asked her, "Aren't you going to invite me to come up?" She did not reply. She leaned on the parapet of her balcony and stared out over the countryside. I looked behind me, down to where the brambles waved above the banked fog in the deep valleys. Was the fog creeping closer? When Nettle continued to ignore me, I trotted around the base of the tower. In the old tale there was no door, and Nettle had recreated it faithfully. Did that mean she had had a lover who had been faithless to her? My heart turned over in me, and for a moment I forgot the purpose of my visit. When I had circled the tower, I sat down on my haunches and looked up at the figure on the balcony. "Who has betrayed you?" I asked her. She continued to stare out, and I thought she would not answer, but then, without looking down at me, she replied, "Everyone, go away." "How can I help you if I go away?"
"You can't help me. You've told me that often enough, so you might as well just go away and leave me alone like everyone else."
"Who has gone away and left you alone?" That brought a furious glare. She spoke in a low voice, full of hurt.
"I don't know why I thought you might remember. My brother, for one, my brother Swift, who you said would soon be coming home to us. Well, he hasn't. And then my stupid father decided to go look for him, as if a man with fogged eyes can go look for anything. And we told him not to go, but he did, and something happened. We don't know what, but his horse came home without him. So I went out on my horse, despite my mother shrieking at me that I wasn't to leave, and I tracked his horse's trail back and found Papa by the side of the road, bruised and bloody, and trying to crawl home, dragging one leg. So I brought him home, and then my mother scolded me again for disobeying her. And now my father is in bed, and all he does is lie there and stare at the wall and not speak to anyone. My mother forbade any of us from bringing him any brandy, so he won't talk to us or tell us what happened, which makes my mother furious at all of us, as if it were my fault.
Halfway through this tirade, her tears had begun to stream down her face. They dripped from her chin and ran over her hands and trickled down the wall of the tower. Slowly they solidified into opal strands of misery. I reached up on my hind legs and clawed at them, but they were too smooth and too shallow for me to gain any purchase. I sat down again. I felt hollow and old. I tried to tell myself that the misery in Molly's home had nothing to do with me, that I had not caused it and could not cure it. And yet, the roots of it ran deep, did they not? After a time she looked down at me and laughed bitterly.
"Well, Shadow Wolf, aren't you going to say you can't help me with that? Isn't that what you always say?"
When I could think of no reply, she added in an accusing tone,
"I don't know why I even speak to you. You lied to me. You said my brother was coming home."
"I thought he was," I replied, finding words at last. "I went to him, and I told him to go home. I thought he had."
"Well, perhaps he tried to. Perhaps he started this way and was killed by robbers, or fell in a river and drowned. I don't suppose you ever considered that 10 is a bit young to be out on the roads alone. I suppose you never thought that it might have been kinder if you had brought him home safely to us instead of sending him. But no, that might have been inconvenient to you."
"Nettle, stop. Let me speak. Swift is safe, alive and safe. He is still here, with me." I paused and tried to breathe. The inevitability of what must follow those words sickened me. "Here it comes, Burrick," I thought to myself. "All the pain I ever tried to save you, all tied up in a tidy package of misery for you and your family." For Nettle asked, as I knew she must,
"And where is safe with you? And how do you know he is safe? How do I know you are a true thing at all? Perhaps you were like the rest of this dream, a thing I made. Look at you, man-wolf. You are not real, and you offer me false hope."
"I am not real as you see me," I replied slowly. "But I am real, and once upon a time your father knew me."
"Once upon a time," she said scornfully. "Another tale from Shadow Wolf. Take your silly stories away."
She took a shuddering breath, and fresh tears started down her face.
"I'm not a child any longer. Your stupid stories can't help me."
So I knew I had lost her. Lost her trust, lost her friendship, lost my chance of knowing my child as a child. Terrible sadness welled up in me, but it was laced with the music of brambles growing. I glanced behind me. The thorn vines and fog had crept higher. Was it just my own dream threatening me, or had Thick's music become even more menacing? I didn't know. "And I came here seeking your help," I reminded myself bitterly.
"My help?"
Nettle asked in a choked voice. I had spoken without thinking. "I know I don't have the right to ask you for anything."
"No, you don't."
She was looking past me.
"What is that, anyway?"
"A dream. A nightmare, actually."
"I thought your nightmares were about falling."
She sounded intrigued. "That's not my nightmare. It belongs to someone else. It's a very strong nightmare. Strong enough to spread out from him and take over the dreams of other people. It's threatening lives, and I don't think the man whose dream it is can control it."
"Just wake him up, then,"
she offered the solution disdainfully. "That might help for a little time, but I need a more permanent solution." For a brief moment I considered telling her the man's nightmare endangered Swift as well. I pushed the thought aside. There was no use frightening her, especially when I wasn't sure she could help me.
"What do you think I could do about it?"
"I thought you could help me go into his dream and change it, make it pleasant and calm, convince him that what is happening to him won't kill him, that he'll be fine. Then his dreams might be calmer. and we could all rest.
How could I do that?
And then, more sharply,
and why should I do that? What do you offer me in exchange, Shadow Wolf?
I did not like it that it had come down to barter, but I had only myself to blame. It was cruelest of all that the only thing I had to offer her would bring pain and guilt for her father. I spoke slowly. As to how, you are very strong in the magic that lets one person walk into another person's dreams and change them, strong enough, perhaps, to shape my friend's dream for him, even though he himself is also very strong in magic, and very frightened.
I have no magic.
I ignored her words. As for why, I have told you that Swift is with me, and safe. You doubt me. I don't blame you, for it appears I have failed you in my earlier assurance, but I will give you words to say to your father. They will be hard for him to hear, but when he hears them he will know that what I say is true, that your brother is alive and well and with me.
Tell me the words, then.
For one brief, chadish moment, I thought of demanding that she first help me with Thick's dreaming. Then I harshly rejected that notion. My daughter owed me exactly what I had given her. Nothing. Perhaps there was also the fear that if I did not speak to her then, I would lose my courage. Uttering those words was like touching my tongue to a glowing coal. I spoke them. Tell him that you dreamed of a wolf with porcupine quills in his muzzle. And that the wolf said to you, "As once you did, so I do now. I shelter and guide your son. I will put my life between him and any harm, and when my task is done, I will bring him safely home to you." I had cloaked my message as best I could under the circumstances. Nettle still struck far too close to the truth when she eagerly asked,
"My father cared for your son years ago."
Some decisions are easier if you don't allow yourself time to think. "Yes," I lied to my daughter. "Exactly." I watched her mull this for a moment. Slowly her tower of glass began to melt into water. It flowed, warm and harmless, past my feet until her balcony had descended to the ground. She offered me her hand to help her climb over the railing. I took it, touching and yet not touching my daughter for the first time in her life. Her tanned fingers rested briefly on my black-clawed paw. Then she stood clear of me and looked down at the fog and creeping briars that were ascending the hillside towards us.
"You know, I've never done anything like this before."
"Neither have I," I admitted.
"Before we go into his dream, tell me something about him,"
she suggested. The fog and bramble crept ever closer. Whatever I told her about Thick would be too much, and yet for her to enter his dream ignorant might be dangerous to all. I could not control what Thick revealed to her in the context of the dream. For one fleeting second I wondered if I should have consulted Chade or Dutiful before seeking Nettle's aid. Then I smiled grimly to myself. I was Skillmaster, was I not? In that capacity this decision was mine, alone. And so I told my daughter that Thick was simple, a man with the mind and heart of a child, and the strength of an army when it came to skill magic. I even told her that he served the Farseer Prince, and that he journeyed with him on a ship. I told her how his powerful skill music and now his dreams were undermining morale on the ship. I told her of his conviction that he would always be seasick and that he would likely die from it. And as I told her these things, the thorns grew and twined towards us. I watched her quickly drawing her own conclusions from what I said. That I was on board the ship also, and therefore that her brother was with me on a sea voyage with the Farseer Prince. Rural as her home was, I wondered how much she had heard of the Narcheska and the prince's quest. I didn't have to wonder long. She put the tale together for herself.
"So that is the black dragon that the silver dragon keeps asking you about, the one the prince goes to slay."
"Don't speak her name," I begged her. She gave me a disdainful look that mocked my foolish fears. Then,
"Here it comes,"
she said quietly, and the brambles engulfed us. They made a crackling sound as they rose around our ankles and then our knees, like fire racing up a tree. The thorns bit into our flesh, and then a dense fog swirled up about us, choking and menacing.
"What is this?" Nettle exclaimed in annoyance.
Then, as the fog stole her from my sight, she exclaimed,
"Stop it, Shadow Wolf! Stop it right now! This is all yours! You made this mess! Let go of it!"
And she wrested my dream from me. It was rather like having someone snatch away your blankets, but most jarring for me was that it evoked a memory I both did and did not recognize. Another time, and an older woman, prying something fascinating and shiny from my chubby-fisted grasp, while saying, "No, Kepit, not for little boys." I was breathless in the sudden banishment of my dream, but in the next instant we literally plunged into fix. The fog and brambles vanished, and the cold salt water closed over my head. I was drowning. No matter how I struggled, I could not get to the top of the water. Then a hand gripped mine, and as Nettle hauled me up to stand beside her, she exclaimed irritably, "You are so gullible! It's a dream, and that's all it is. Now it's my dream, and in my dream we can walk on the waves. Come on." She said it, and it was so. Still, I held onto her hand and walked beside her. All around us the water stretched out, glittering, shoreless from horizon to horizon. Thick music was the wind blowing all around us. I squinted out over the water, wondering how we would ever find Thick in the trackless waves. But Nettle squeezed my hand and announced clearly through Thick's wild song, "We're very close to him now." And that too was so. A few steps more, and she dropped to her knees with an exclamation of pity. The blinding sunlight on the water hid whatever she stared at. I knelt beside her and felt my heart break. He knew it too well. He must have seen it sometime. The drowned kitten floated just beneath the water. Too young even for his eyes to be opened, he dangled, weightlessly in the sea's grip. His fur floated around him, but as Nettle reached in to grip him by the scruff of the neck and pull him out, his coat sleeked suddenly flat with the water. He dangled from her hand, water streaming from his tail and paws and dribbling from his nose and open red mouth. She cupped the little creature fearlessly in her hand. She bent over him intently, experimentally flexing the small ribcage between her thumb and forefingers. Then she held the tiny face close to hers and blew a sudden puff of air into the open red mouth. In those moments, she was entirely Burrick's daughter. So I had seen him clear birth mucus from a newborn puppy's throat. "You're all right now," she told the kitten authoritatively. She stroked the tiny creature, and in the wake of her hand, his fur was dry and soft. He was striped orange and white, I suddenly saw. A moment before, I thought he had been black. "You're alive and safe, and I will not let any evil befall you, and you know that you can trust me, because I love you." At her words, my throat closed up and choked me. I wondered how she knew them to say. All my life, without knowing it, I had wanted someone to say those words to me, and have them be true and believable. It was like watching someone give to another the gift you had always longed for. And yet, I did not feel bitterness or envy. All I felt was wonder that at 16 she would have that in her to give to another. Even if I could have found Thick in his dream, even if someone had told me those were the words I must say, the words he most desperately needed to hear, I could not have said them and made them true, as she did. She was my daughter, blood of my blood. And yet the wonder and amazement she made me feel at that moment made her a creation entirely apart from me. The kitten stirred in her hand. It looked about blindly. When the little red mouth opened wide, I was prepared for a yowl. Instead, it questioned in a hoarse little voice.
"Ma'am?"
"No," Nettle replied. My daughter was braver than I. She did not even consider the easy lie.
"But someone like her."
Nettle looked around the seascape, as if noticing it for the first time.
"And this is not a good place for someone like you. Let's change it, shall we? Where do you like to be?"
His answers surprised me. She coaxed the information from him, detail by detail. When they were finished, we sat, doll-sized, in the center of an immense bed. In the distance, I could make out the hazy walls of a travelling wagon, such as many puppeteer families and street performers lived in when they travelled from town to town. It smelled of the dried peppers and braided onions that were roped across one corner of the ceiling. Now I recognised the music around us, not just as Thick's mother song, but also the elements that comprised it. The steady breathing of a sleeping woman, the creak of wheels, and the slow-paced thudding of a team's hoofbeats,
woven as a backdrop for a woman's humming and a childish tune on a whistle. It was a song of safety and acceptance and content.
"I like it here," Nettle told him when they were finished. "Perhaps, if you don't mind, I'll come and visit you here again. Would that be all right?"
The kitten purred, and then curled up, not sleeping, but simply being safe in the middle of the huge bed. Nettle stood up to go. I think that was when I realized that I was watching Thick's dream, but was no longer a part of it. I had vanished from it, along with all other discordant and dangerous elements. I had no place in his mother's world.
"Farewell for now," Nettle told him, and added, "Now remember how easy it is to come here. When you decide to sleep, all you have to do is think of this cushion."
She touched one of the many brightly embroidered pillows on the bed.
"Remember this, and when you dream, you'll come straight here. Can you do that?"
The kitten rumbled a purr in response, and then Thick's dream began to fade around me. In a moment I stood again on the hillside by the melted glass tower. The brambles and fog had vanished, leaving a vista of green valleys and shining rivers threading through them. "You didn't tell him he wouldn't be seasick any more," I suddenly remembered. Then I winced at how ungrateful my words sounded. Nettle scowled at me, and I saw the weariness in her eyes.
"Do you think it was easy to find all those things and assemble them around him? He kept trying to change it all back into cold seawater."
She rubbed her eyes.
"I'm sleeping, and yet I suspect I'm going to wake exhausted."
"I apologize," I answered gravely. "Well do I know that magic can take a toll." I spoke without thinking.
"Magic?" she snorted. "This dream shaping is not magic. It's just a thing I can do."
And with that thought, she left me. I pushed from my mind the dread of what might be said when she gave Burrick my words. There was nothing I could do about any of that. I sat down at the base of her tower, but without Nettle to anchor it, the dream was already fading. I sank through it into a dreamless sleep of my own.
Chapter 7. Voyage. Do not make the error of thinking of the Out Islands as a kingdom under a sole monarch, such as we have in the Six Duchies, or even as an alliance of peoples such as we see in the Mountain Kingdom. Not even the individual islands, small as they may seem, are under the sole command of any single lord or noble. In fact, there are no nobles or lords recognized among the Out-Islanders. Men have status according to their prowess as warriors and the richness of the spoils they bring back. Some have the backing of their matriarchal clans to enhance whatever reputation they may claim by force of arms. Clans hold territory on the islands, it is true, but these lands are the matriarchal farmlands and gathering beaches owned by the women and passed down through their daughters. Towns, especially harbour towns, belong to no single clan, and mob law is generally the rule in them. The city guard will not come to your aid if you are robbed or assaulted in an out-island town. Each man is expected to enforce the respect others should give him. Cry out for help, and you will be judged weak and beneath notice. Sometimes, however, the dominant clan in the area may have a strong house in the town and set itself up in judgment over disputes there. The Out-Islanders do not build castles and forts such as we have in the Six Duchies. A siege is more likely to be conducted by enemy vessels taking control of a harbour or river mouth rather than by a force attempting to seize land. It is not unusual, however, to find one or two clan stronghouses in each major town. These are fortified structures built to withstand attack and often having deep cellars, with not only a well for water, but also substantial storage for food. These strong houses usually belonged to the dominant clan in each town and were designed more for shelter from civil strife than to withstand foreign attack. Shelby's Out-Island Travels. When I awoke, I could feel that the ship was calmer. I had not slept for many hours, but I felt rested. About me on the deck, men still sprawled, immersed in slumber, as if they had not slept well in days, as was the case. I rose carefully, bundling my blanket in my arms and stepping through the prone bodies. I put my blanket back into my sea chest, changed into a cleaner shirt, and then went back on deck. Night was venturing toward morning. The clouds had rained themselves out, and fading stars showed through their rent curtains. The canvas had been reset to take advantage of a kindlier wind. The barefoot sailors moved in quiet competence on the deck. It felt like the dawn after a storm. I found Thick curled up and sleeping, the lines on his face slack and peaceful, his breathing hoarse and steady. Nearby, Webb dozed, his head drooped forward onto his bent knees. My eyes could barely make out the dark shape of a seabird perched on the railing. It was a gull of some sort, larger than the average. I caught the bright glint of Risk's eye and nodded to her in affable greeting as I approached slowly, giving Webb time to open his eyes and lift his head. He smiled at me.
"He seems to be resting better. Perhaps the worst is over."
"I hope so," I replied. Cautiously, I opened myself to Thick's music. It was no longer a storm of skill, but was still as constant as the shushing waves. His mother's song had become dominant in it again, but I heard also the trace of a kitten purring, and a reassuring echo of Nettle's voice assuring him that he was loved and safe. That unsettled me a bit. I wondered if I only heard it because I had witnessed the change, or if Chade and the prince would also detect her words and voice.
"You look more rested as well," Webb observed,
his voice abruptly recalling me to my manners and myself. "Yes, I am, and I thank you." He extended a hand to me, and I took it, helping him onto his feet. Once upright, he released my hand and rolled his shoulders to limberness again. On the railing, his bird waddled a step or two closer. In the gathering light, I marked the deep yellow of her beak and feet. Somewhere in Burrick's tutelage, I seemed to recall that bright colours were indicative of a well-nourished bird. This creature gleamed with health. As if aware of my admiration, she turned her head and carefully preened a long flight feather through her bill. Then, as effortlessly as a cat lofts into a chair, she rose from the railing, her cupped wings catching the wind and lifting her in flight. "Show off?" Webb muttered. He smiled at me. It came to me that wit partners take the same inane pride in one another that parents do in their children. I smiled back, commiserating.
"Ah, that looks genuine. In time, my friend, I think you will come to trust me. Tell me when you do."
I gave a small sigh. It would have been courteous to insist that I already trusted him. But I did not think I could lie well enough to deceive him. So I simply nodded. Then, as he turned to go, I remembered Swift.
"I've another favour I would ask of you," I said awkwardly.
He turned back to me, sincere pleasure in his face. "I'll take that as an indication of progress."
Could you ask Swift to give me some of his time today? I'd like to talk to him."
Webb cocked his head like a gull regarding a dubious clamshell.
"Are you going to browbeat him about returning to his father?"
I considered. Was I?
"No. I'm only going to tell him that I regard it as essential to my honour that he return safely to Buckkeep, and that I expect him to keep up his lessons with me while on this journey."
Oh, that would please Chade, I thought sourly. My time already was stretched thin, and I was taking up yet another task.
Webb smiled warmly. "It would please me greatly to send him to you to hear those things," he replied.
He offered me a sailor's brief bow before he departed, and I nodded back. A skilled suggestion from me meant that the prince rose early and was on the deck beside Thick when he finally stirred. A servant had brought up a small basket with warm bread and a pot of hot tea in it. The smell of it made me aware I was ravenous. He set it on the deck near Thick, and then the prince dismissed him. We stood silently staring out over the sea, waiting for Thick to awaken.
When did his music change? When I awoke this morning, I could not believe how relaxed and rested I felt. It took me some time before I realized what the change was.
It's such a relief, isn't it? I wanted to say more, but dared not.
I could not admit to the prince that I had tampered with Thick's dreams, because I wasn't really the one who had done it. I doubted that Thick had even been aware I was there. Thick's awakening saved me. He coughed, and then opened his eyes. He looked up at Dutiful and me, and a slow smile spread over his face.
"Nettle fixed my dream for me," he said.
Before either Dutiful or I could respond to his words, he went off in a fit of coughing. Then,
"I don't feel good. My throat hurts."
I seized the opportunity to divert the conversation. "It's probably from all the retching you've done. Look, Thick, Dutiful has brought you tea and fresh bread. The tea will ease your throat. Shall I pour you some?" His only reply was another spell of coughing. I crouched down beside him and touched his cheek. His face was warm, but he had just awakened and he was still wrapped in wool blankets. It didn't mean he had a fever. He pushed the blankets away irritably and then sat shivering in his wrinkled, damp clothing. He looked miserable, and his music began to swirl discordantly. The prince took action.
"Badgerlock, bring that basket. Thick, you are coming back into the cabin with me, immediately."
"I don't want to,"
he groaned, then shocked me by slowly standing up. He staggered a step, then looked out over the rolling waves, and seemed to recall.
"I'm seasick."
"That's why I want to take you to the cabin. You'll get better there," the prince told him.
"No, I won't,"
Thick insisted. But all the same, when Dutiful started off towards the cabin, he slowly fell in behind him. His gait was unsteady, as much from weakness as from the gentle shifting of the deck. I stepped up to take his arm and escorted him, the laden basket on my other arm. He wobbled along beside me. We stopped twice for coughing spells, and by the time we reached the door of the prince's cabin, my concern had become worry. Dutiful's chamber was more elaborate and better furnished than his bedchamber at home. Obviously someone else had designed it to a buckkeep idea of what a prince merited. It had a bank of windows that looked out onto the wake behind the ship. There were rich carpets over the polished deck, and heavy furniture that was well anchored against the sway of the ship. I would probably have been more impressed if I had lingered there longer, but Thick arrowed for his own small room that opened off the main chamber. It was far more modest, little more than a closet the size of his bunk with a space beneath it for storing personal items. The architect of the ship had probably intended it for a valet rather than a bedchamber for the prince's pet simpleton. Thick immediately crumpled onto the bed. He moaned and muttered as I shook him out of his stained and sweaty clothing. When I covered him with a light blanket, he clutched it to himself and complained, teeth chattering, of the cold. I fetched him a stuffed coverlet from the foot of the prince's own bed. I was certain of his fever now. The pot of tea had cooled a bit, but I poured a cup for Thick and sat by him while he drank it. At my skilled suggestion, the prince sent for the willow bark tea for his fever and raspberry root syrup for his cough. When the servant finally brought them, it took me some time to coax Thick to accept them. But his stubbornness seemed to have been eroded by the fever, and he gave way to me. The room was so small that I could not shut the door while I was sitting on the edge of his bed. So it remained open, and I idly watched the flow of people through my prince's chamber as I tended our simpleton. I found little of interest, until Dutiful's witted coterie arrived. They were Civil, Webb, the minstrel Cockle, and Swift. Dutiful was seated at the table, softly rehearsing his out-islander speech when they came in. As the servant admitted them, and then was dismissed, he pushed the scroll aside with apparent relief. Civil's cat padded in at his heels and immediately made himself comfortable on the prince's bed. No one seemed to take any notice of him. Webb glanced at me, bemused, before he greeted the prince.
"All's fair aloft, Prince Dutiful."
I thought it was an odd courtesy, until it dawned on me that he was relaying the word from his bird, Risk.
"No ships save our own are in sight."
"Excellent," the prince smiled his approval before he turned his attention to the others. "How fares your cat today, Civil?" Civil held up his hand. His sleeve fell back to expose a raised red scratch the length of his forearm.
"Bored and irritated with the confinement. He'll be glad when we see land again."
All the witted ones laughed indulgently together.
as parents would over a child's willfulness. I marked how comfortable they all seemed in the prince's presence. Only Swift seemed to retain any stiffness, and that could have been due to either his awareness of me or the age difference between him and the rest of the company. So had Verity's closest nobles been with him, I recalled, and thought to myself that the casual affection of those men was more valuable than the way Regal's hangers-on used to bow and scrape to him. So it did not seem overly odd when Webb turned to look at me, and then asked dutiful, "And has Tom Badgerlock come to join us today, my prince?" Two questions rode in his words. Was I there to admit my wit, and possibly my identity? And would I be joining their coterie? I held my breath as dutiful answered. "Not exactly, Webb. He tends my man thick. I understand you kept watch by him during the night to allow Badgerlock some rest, and for that I thank you. Yet now Thick has taken a cough from his night exposure, and is feverish. He finds Badgerlock's company soothing, and so the man has agreed to sit with him." "Ah, I see. Well, Thick, I'm sorry to hear you are ill." As he spoke, Webb came to peep in through the door. At the table behind him, the rest of the coterie continued their quiet conversation. Swift watched Webb anxiously. Thick, huddled in his blankets and staring at the wall, seemed only mildly aware of him. Even his skill music seemed subdued and muted, as if he lacked the energy to drive it. When Thick made no response, Webb touched me softly on the shoulder and said quietly, "I'll be happy to take a watch beside him tonight, too, if you'd like the rest. In the meanwhile..." He turned from me and gestured at Swift, whose face clouded with sudden apprehension. "I'll leave my page here with you. Doubtless you two have much to discuss, and if there are any errands that can be run for Thick's comfort, I'm sure Swift will be glad to fetch for you. Isn't that right, lad?" Swift was in an untenable position, and he knew it. He came to heel like a whipped dog and stood beside Webb, eyes downcast. "Yes, sir," he replied softly. He lifted his gaze to me, and I didn't like what I saw there. It was fear coupled with dislike, and I did not feel I had done anything to justify either of those emotions. "Swift," Webb said, drawing the boy's eyes back to him. He went on quietly, in a voice pitched for our ears alone. "It will be fine. Trust me. Tom wishes to be sure you will continue your education while you are aboard this ship. That is all." "Actually, there is more," I said, unwillingly. That made both of them stare at me. Webb lifted a brow. "I've given a promise," I said slowly. "To your family, Swift. I promised that I'd put my life between you and anything that threatened you. I've promised that I'll do my best to see you safely home when all this is over."
"What if I don't want to go home when this is all over?"
Swift asked me insolently, his voice rising. I felt more than saw the prince become aware of the conversation, and then the boy added indignantly,
"Wait, how did you talk to my father? There wasn't time for you to send a messenger and then get a reply before we left. You're lying."
I drew a slow breath through my nostrils. When I could speak calmly, I replied, keeping my voice pitched low, "No, I am not lying. I sent my promise to your family. I didn't say they had replied. I still consider it just as binding."
"There wasn't time," he protested, but more quietly.
Webb looked at him disapprovingly. I scowled. Webb flicked a disapproving glance at me, but I met it steadily. I'd promised to keep the boy alive and return him home. That didn't mean I had to tolerate his insults gladly.
"I suppose this may be a long voyage for both of you," Webb observed. "I'll leave you to each other's company, and hope you both learn to make the best of it. I believe you each have something to offer the other, but you'll only value it if you discover it for yourselves."
"I'm cold,"
Thick moaned, rescuing me from Webb's lecture. "There's your first errand," I told Swift brusquely. "Ask the prince's serving man where you can find two more blankets for Thick, wool ones, and bring him a big mug of water as well." I think it offended his dignity to fetch things for a half-wit,
but he found it preferable to remaining in my company. As Swift scuttled off, Webb gave a sigh.
"Truth between the two of you," he advised me. "It's going to be your only bridge to reaching that boy, Tom, and he needs you to reach him. I'm only realizing that now. He ran from his home, and he ran from you. He has to stop running, or he'll never learn to stand and face down his problems."
So he thought I was one of Swift's problems. I looked away. "I'll deal with him," I said. Webb sighed wearily.
"I'll leave him to you, then."
Webb returned to the table and the witted coterie's conversation. After a time, they all left. The prince resumed rehearsing his speech. By the time Swift returned with blankets and a mug of water for Thick, I'd combed through Dutiful's collection of scrolls and selected several I thought would benefit Swift. To my surprise, I found some I hadn't seen before. Chade must have acquired them just before we sailed. They dealt with out-island society and customs. I chose the simpler ones for Swift. I made Thick as comfortable as I could. His fever was rising. The hotter he became, the more fantastic the music he skilled. He still hadn't taken in any food, but at least he'd lost the will to fight me, as I held the mug to his mouth and made sure that he drank it all. I settled him again, tucking the blanket snugly around him, and wondering how the heat of a fever could make a man think he was cold. When I finished, I glanced up to find Swift looking at us in distaste. "He smells funny," the boy complained to my reproving glance. "He's sick," I pointed at the floor as I resumed my seat at the edge of Thick's bed. "Sit there and read aloud to us, quietly, from that scroll. No, the one with the frayed edge there. Yes, that one." "What is it?" he asked needlessly as he untied the scroll and opened it. "It's a description of the history and people of the Out-Islands." "Why do I need to read this?" I ticked the reasons off on my fingers. "Because you need to practice your reading, because we are going there, and it behoves you to know something about the people there so you don't shame your prince. Because the history of the six duchies is entwined with that of the Out-Islands. And because I said so." He lowered his eyes, but I sensed no mellowing toward me. I had to prompt him again before he began reading it, but once he began, I think he interested himself. The rise and fall of his boyish voice was soothing. I let my thoughts float on that sound, barely taking in the sense of the words. He was still reading when Chade entered. Ostensibly I paid no attention to the old man, while he conferred quietly with the prince. Then Dutiful skill touched me. "Chade would like you to dismiss Swift for a time so we could speak freely here." "A moment." I nodded as if to myself over what Swift had just read. When he drew breath, I reached out to touch his shoulder. "That's enough for today. You can go. But I will be here tomorrow, and so should you be. I'll expect you."
"Yes, sir."
There was no anticipation, no resignation in his voice. Just a flat acknowledgement. I suppressed a sigh. He went to the prince, made his curtsy, and was dismissed. At a skill nudge from me, Dutiful let him know that he thought education a desirable advantage for every man, and that he too wished to see Swift at his lessons every day. He received the same lackluster assent that I had, and then Swift went his way. The door had scarcely closed behind him before Chade was at my side. "How is he?" he asked gravely as he touched Thick's face. "Feverish and coughing. He has taken water, but no food." Chade sat down heavily on the edge of the bed. He felt Thick's throat just under his jaw, and then slipped his hand inside his collar, assessing his fever. "For how long," he asked me, "has he been fasting?" "It has been at least 3 days since he took any substantial food that stayed with him." Chade breathed out noisily. "Well, that is where we must begin. Get nourishment into him. Salty broths, thick with soft meat and vegetables." I nodded, but Thick groaned and turned his face to